Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me is my colleague Peter Flaherty, and we are here ahead of the third weekend of the season, and it's been quite an exciting couple of weeks so far, Peter. But this third weekend, I'm really ready for this one. It's the most loaded weekend of this slate so far. It's always one of the biggest weekends before conference play starts, just in terms of tournaments, rivalry series, big time, like major programs squaring off kind of series. So we're going to get into that. Got several different things to watch this weekend. But we also do want to talk a little bit about the week that was. Some big things around the country, of course. There was Hagan Smith going crazy last Friday in Arlington. Arkansas and Oregon State put on a great show at Globe Life Field. We have ECU taking down UNC in what was the series so far of the very young season. And we've got a lot to talk about from last week as well, Peter. It's just exciting that we've got, we're really getting into the heart of the action now.
Yeah, we're in full swing. It's been a fun season so far with great performances on both the team level and individual level. Like you said, there were some notable things that happened last weekend, but this is the, in terms of early weekends, this upcoming weekend is one that I've had circled since all of the schedules have been out. It is a loaded slate, both for multi-team events in these tournaments and also on just a one-on-one series level.
Well, let's start with Hagan Smith and that 17 strikeout performance on Friday night against Oregon State. That was incredible. He struck out the first five innings. Every out he recorded was via strikeout. He looked like he should be pitching for the Rangers, not for the Razorbacks, on Friday. And it was everything you would want to see from your preseason All-American ace if you're Arkansas, and especially so considering that his opening weekend start was just one inning. It was not good. He threw 42 pitches and had to be lifted after that against James Madison at home. And, you know, after the game, Dave Van Horn said like nothing was wrong with Smith, and he, you know, hypothesized a couple of things that might have happened, but like nothing was wrong with him physically. And so we wanted to see what it was going to be like having to face one of the best offenses in the country in Oregon State on the big stage at Globe Life. And what it was everything that Hagan Smith can be. It was a spectacular outing. Those 17 strikeouts in six innings, just remarkable. And Arkansas did win the game, though Hagan Smith did not factor in the decision, because once Oregon State got him out of the game, they were able to do some damage against the bullpen, tied the game at four. Arkansas, however, they did win. They get their last run late. They go on to win 5-4, and it was an epic game, just in terms of, you know, individual performance from Hagan Smith, and then just the way the game as a whole went down. It was everything you would want in a college baseball game.
It was an instant classic, and in the early going, that had more of a super regional College World Series type feel to it, and I wouldn't be shocked in the slightest if one of, if not both, those two teams are in Omaha come the end of the year and playing each other. But the story, obviously, is Hagan Smith. I don't have years and years of experience just because I'm young, but that's the best in-game pitching performance, if not like right there, that I've ever seen. It was dominant, masterful in every sense of the word. It left me speechless. And granted, I and a lot of others weren't watching it live because it was on Flow Sports. But the Arkansas Twitter account did a great job of regularly posting videos and all of that, but it was outstanding. He was up to 100 with his fastball. He was sitting 97-99 for the entirety of his outing with plenty of life through the zone. The mid to high 80s slider was lethal. It was a no doubt plus pitch. It generated a ton of whiffs. It looked like he was just, I mean, it was complete blinders down attack mode. Like he was on complete cruise control. And the command and control were both impeccable. It's far beyond even describing it as like a bounce back outing from a rough first inning against James Madison. Like it bolstered his draft case. And I think he now becomes one of, if not the most exciting arm to follow, certainly one of very few arms, that's like the most exciting to follow going forward in the draft cycle. But it was absolutely incredible. I was speechless, and I'm sure you were as well, but that was a heck of a bounce back effort from Mr. Smith.
So don't apologize for like getting caught up and saying that was the best one you'd ever seen just because you're on the younger side. There were people older than you that frankly should know better, that were saying the same thing. And I don't want to downplay what Hagan Smith did at all here. It's going to sound like I will in a second, but I promise that's not what I'm trying to do. Steven Strasburg struck out 23 batters in a game once, and Kamar Rocker threw a no-hitter with like 19 strikeouts in a super regional, and Ty Floyd struck out 17 in the College World Series finals last year. Like, what Smith did in six innings, incredible. I'm not trying to take anything away from him, but like the people that are saying like that's the best start ever, like the level of pressure that he's doing it at in the regular season is just different from what like Floyd or Rocker was doing. And like, I don't want to compare anyone to Steven Strasburg, and it's tough to compare across like the era of college baseball that we're talking about. And also like Steven Strasburg did it in a conference game, but it was against Utah when they were in the Mountain West, versus Smith doing it against Oregon State, a lineup that we think is one of the best in the country right now, and you know, is an Omaha caliber team. So like, it's hard to compare these things, but like I didn't want to pour cold water on it on Friday night, but I would like people just to like take a step back. I know that's not what Twitter is for, but like, it was awesome. It just doesn't have to be like, you know, the greatest thing ever. Now, if it's the best thing you've seen, like that's different. Just to put this into context, like it was really cool. It was awesome. But a dude did strike out 17 in the College World Series finals just a year ago. And like, yeah, it took Ty Floyd 8 innings to do it, but also it was the College World Series finals and he was facing Florida. So, you know, like,
yeah, when I cool said, too. Yeah, no, that was decent. And we both were watching that one together. And it was incredible. When I said one of the Floyd one was what I was thinking of. And then honestly, the Skeens and Louder in their matchups. Yeah. Like on a game level, obviously that's one of the best. But then both of those pitching matchups in and of themselves were also excellent. And then I think what adds to what Hagan Smith did, he could have done this against any team in the country, at the Division I level, and it would have been remarkable. Baseball's the hardest sport in the world, but the fact that he did it against Oregon State, where it's an Omaha level team early on, it's looking like they have one of, if not the best lineup in college baseball, I think it just adds to the impressiveness. So, unbelievable outing.
What I want to ask, before we move on from Smith is, who, like, is he the best college pitcher on the draft board right now? Like, is that too much? I know, obviously, you know, coming into the season, he was quite highly regarded. Chase Burns has been really good out of the gate, but who would you have number one right now if you're just ranking college starting pitchers in the 24 draft class?
Whew. It's a good question. That's a very good question, actually. Recency bias plays into it. That's a very good question, and I can't stall because it'd be bad listening for the podcast. You know what? I'll stick with Chase Burns. I got Chase Burns 1A, Hagan Smith 1B, as you can tell by my long-winded, very articulate answer, it is like splitting hairs. It's extremely tough to decide. The Smith outing was that loud. You've got a 6'3 lefty who he was already like, he was a strong kid with physicality last year, but he looks more of like a workhorse this year. And you've got a left-handed pitcher that I'm pretty convinced is going to be a starter at the next level. You get the little lefty bonus. You've got a plus slider, borderline plus slider, plus heater from the left side. And then you flip over to Burns. You've got this high-waisted, another prototypical pitcher build with a, again, fastball slider combination with both, I think, grading out as double plus, a budding third option and a changeup. But it is really hard to kind of pick one or the other. I think that no matter who is picking up in those first 12 to 15 or so picks, they're going to be happy with wherever, if Burns and or Hartle, or excuse me, if Burns and or Smith are on the board for him. So it's very difficult, but those two guys would be my top ones right now. And you can flip them either way, and I would not disagree with you. I like, gun to my head, it's Burns right now. But if I don't know why I keep saying Josh Hartle, if Hagen Smith can keep stacking these outings, and granted, he's not going to go out and throw 6 shutout innings and allow 2 hits and strike out 17 every weekend. If he does that, he's going 1-1. But he's not going to do it. If he can kind of maintain the same themes, though, largely, that he flashed on Friday, that's only going to just keep strengthening his case to warrant a potential top 10 overall pick. Like, the command and control, like, he was dotting everything. If he can keep showing advanced command and control, that's going to help him. The advanced pitch sequencing, that's all going to help him, and just solidify himself as a starter. But those two guys at the top, and then I guess a sleeper third one right now for me is Jonathan Santucci. Not that you asked, but he's one that I think is like lurking in that conversation. I think when all is said and done, he might be like on the outside looking in terms of number one arm, but I think that he is closer than a lot of people think.
The big thing for me with Smith in that outing and going forward is like, yeah, okay, he was throwing 99 and the slider was absurd, but it was really that control and the command portion of it, because that's been the downfall of him in the past. And the consistency, like you said, like doing not that, because like he's not going to do that again, but doing something like that, just showing the consistent strike throwing ability and the ability to throw the pitches where he wants them, like that's going to be what pushes him up. And like the same can be said for Burns. Like those are both of their bugaboos. Like nobody has ever questioned either of their stuff. It's about like, well, how consistent can you be and how many strikes can you throw with your incredible like raw stuff. So that's what you're watching going forward if you're you know, watching Arkansas or Wake Forest and those two guys specifically.
No, I was just gonna say, to like Smith on Friday, to the command and control point, like catcher could have told him to hit a specific lace on his catcher's mitt and he would have hit it. But yeah, I'm excited to see how he does going forward.
The rest of the Arkansas rotation showed up very well as well the rest of the weekend. Brady Tigert the following day, and then Mason Molina threw 5 hitless against Michigan, overmatched Michigan on Sunday. And it looked like Arkansas might have the best rotation in the country. I mean, we can sit here and debate them versus Wake Forest, or if somebody wanted to throw somebody else into the mix, like I suppose. But like really, it's those two right now. And we don't have to debate that now. It's not a debate worth having on February 28th. However, I do think it's very notable that Arkansas's rotation came out and performed that way, because right now Arkansas's offense is a little slow out of the gate. And like that was kind of to be expected. It's a new look offense. They replaced a lot of guys, but if the rotation is going to do that, you don't need Arkansas to be one of the best offenses in the country. You just need them to be functional. And, you know, they went 2-1 on the weekend. They got caught in a game against Oklahoma State. They lost 2-1 in extras. And like, that's kind of the concern if the offense doesn't figure things out. But the good news is it's February 28th and Oklahoma State's really good. But I do think that, you know, those two developments, both the offensive, like they didn't score that many runs in Globe Life in any of the three games, but the rotation showing up the way that it did, I think those two developments were notable for the Razorbacks.
Extremely loud. And Tigert, when talking about Tigert and Molina following suit with Smith, Tigert, like on paper, has the more electric arm talent and the electric stuff. You meant like with the banger curveball, he's got a solid fastball. And then Molina is the kind of pitchability lefty, but I mean, he flashed a four pitch mix, really, really knows how to pitch, which was super impressive. Notched, like, I was impressed with him in his first 2 years at Texas Tech, just with how he knows how to pitch, the pitchability aspect of it, the pitch sequencing, and he flashed that in start number two for Arkansas. And I think that at this point, when you talk about the best rotations, it's them and Wake, for sure. And I think that at this point, like, there is a very strong case for the Razorbacks, but you can't go wrong with either. And then beyond the rotation, they have a bevy of bullpen weapons as well. Namely, Gabe Gackle is one kid that he's going to be a serious, serious problem for a few years in the SEC. Like, he is an electric little right-hander, advanced strike thrower, fastball up in the upper 90s with a hammer breaking ball with sharp downward teeth, really good pitch traits to it. Jake Faherty is thunderous stuff. Gage Wood has been excellent in the early going. Will McIntyre has been really good. And when you combine those, that the plethora of weapons they have on the mound in offense, like you said, it hasn't really gotten going yet. But I do feel confident in guys like Vahevo Loy picking it up, Hudson White picking it up. Ty Wilmsmeyer, I think, is going to be kind of your steady Eddie type of guy. We've mentioned him a few times as someone who's going to contribute in a number of ways and can contribute in a number of ways, whether it's with his glove, driving a ball into a gap, stealing a couple bases. Like, he's just a good baseball player. And I know it's a simple phrase, but he's just a very solid player. And then I think that you have to be happy with the production early on from guys like Jared Sprigg-Lott, Kendall Diggs, Peyton Holt's a fun little player. It is a, like, speaking to how good they are, not only was that win against Oregon State extremely impressive, but I know when we were doing our ranking on Sunday night, our weekly ranking call, if they had come out of this weekend 3-0, like, there would have been discussion having them perhaps as the number one team in the country. I don't know if it would have happened, but we would have talked about it. So I'm very, very bullish on the Hogs going forward. They've got a pretty light schedule as they head into SEC play. So I'll be looking for the offense as a whole to get into more of a rhythm, particularly the few guys that we had mentioned that were off to slower starts, but it's hard not to be thrilled in Fayetteville right now.
Yeah, we went long on the Hogs there, but that's probably the last time we're going to talk about them for like 2 weeks. So there's your Arkansas update for.
I was hoping we'd go in depth on the Murray State series next week, but
yeah, well, that's you got that one circled. We'll definitely have to dive into that one as well. Oregon State, I feel like, had just about as impressive a week as anyone in the country, maybe more than. And that's even after getting just, you know, like totally owned by Hagan Smith for six innings. But they beat Texas Tech in a midweek. They added a win against Minnesota on Monday, finishing up their time in Arizona. And then they go and they win. They bounce back and they win on Saturday and Sunday. And they took care of Oklahoma State and Michigan quite handily in Arlington. And I don't have a ton of new ground to cover on Oregon State. I just want to say that, like, you just heard how excited we are about Arkansas and how much, like, how good we feel about them. But, like, the team that Oregon State lost to, like, is really, really good. And I feel like Oregon State was, like, right there with them. And it took like a Herculean effort by the Arkansas pitching staff to hold off Oregon State. Like, I mean, you don't want to have happen for the first six innings. Like, you don't want that to happen to you as an offense. But I do think it's notable that that's what it took to slow Oregon State down. And like, Arkansas still only got out of there with a one run win.
Yeah. And like you said, Oregon State didn't even, they hardly put the ball in play for two thirds of the game. And they lost a one run battle to one of the best teams in the country. And granted, they're probably never again this year going to get into a game like that, where it's that much of a pitcher's duel and they're getting carved like that. That lineup is extremely good. I think that what's going to be key for them, and what is huge news looming, I have no intel and I'm not like trying to drop a foreshadow here, but is what happened with Aiden May, the severity or lack thereof of whatever he was dealing with on Friday. He came out of the game after four and a thirds inning. He looked good at times, gave up three runs, but slider really flashed, had his mid-90s fastball going. It's an arm you can feel really confident in and excited about trotting out there on Fridays. And I think that if it's a severe injury, which again, I have no clue as to the severity.
It doesn't sound like it. Mitch Canham the next day made it sound like he just kind of didn't feel right, so they got him out. But like, until he pitches this Friday, like, it's hard to know, you know?
Right. And like this early, to your point, if your guy is feeling any sort of discomfort in any part of his body, like, you're going to yank him, even in a great game as the one we had on Friday night. There is zero reason to leave someone in. So it'll be interesting to see what comes of that. Travis Bezzana for me right now is my 1-1. I know that's a crazy hot take, but just, I mean, as good of a hitter and in my mind, the best hitter in the country, barrel control is off the charts. It's thunderous bat and hand speed, just a super, super explosive operation with an outstanding approach. I mean, we could go on and on about him and his play style, but an immense fan, a huge fan of Bezzana. And then you mentioned the supporting cast around him has been, like, we were high on the Beavers coming into the year and the depth they had on both sides of the baseball, but the offense as a whole is somehow exceeding the expectations, at least I had. Like, Micah McDowell has been great. Trent Carraway has hit the ground running, not as much as another freshman in the country that we'll talk about, but Brady Casper, Gavin Turley, huge early on, has, like, the tools with Turley are undeniable. Like, he is, in the 2025 class, he is one of the more tooled out kids. He's just got to put it together. So far, he's put it together largely, and we've all seen the statistical output. He's been, from a production standpoint, the team's most productive hitter, with 13 RBIs. Mason Guerra has also driven in 13. Like, they can beat you in so, so many ways, and they're comfortable getting into any style of game. And the one spark plug who is yet to get going, and I hope and think he will, is Elijah Hanlon, shortstop. Fun player, can run. He's a twitchy athlete. I liked his hit ability last year at Washington State. He's gotten off to a slow start. But I hope and think he'll pick it up. And then they have, beyond May on the mound, they've got a number of weapons both in the rotation, the bullpen. It's a very, very complete team.
Elsewhere, we had East Carolina taking on North Carolina in a cross-state series. They started with, like, as great as Arkansas and Oregon State was on Friday night, like, if that hadn't happened, everyone would have been talking about how good ECU-UNC was on Friday night, because that game was awesome. UNC won 2-1. It was 1-1 in the eighth inning when Vance Honeycutt came up and hit a homer to left to give UNC the edge. UNC closes the door in the ninth. They get the win. Then ECU came back the next 2 days and they won both of those games. They take the middle game, like relatively easily, at least by the standards of this series, in the neutral site. They played it in Fayetteville, North Carolina, in the minor league park there. And then they go to Greenville for the finale, and ECU gets an early lead. But then once they got into their bullpen, they really had trouble stopping UNC's offense. And the game just went back and forth, and both of these teams, like literally in every half inning, the lead was changing. They were just throwing like these huge haymakers, you know, clutch home runs, clutch hits, just everything. Nobody could get control of the game. And so, of course, because ECU had the bat last, they win 10-9. True freshman Bristol Carter with the walk-off hit there. But I mean, really, like if they had kept playing, like ECU would have coughed up that lead, and UNC would have then coughed up their lead. It just would have kept going forever, I feel like. It was a fantastic series. ECU comes out with a huge series win. They really needed something like that on their resume if they're going to, you know, look at hosting, because the American probably is not going to provide an opportunity like this. So it's only February, but ECU kind of needed that one. And they went out and they got it, despite a really tough Friday night loss in Chapel Hill.
Yeah, the last point you made is a great one, and it's a great series win in the moment. You beat a top 16 team in the country and a rival at that. It's a really hard fought win, but this series win is gonna it will stick with them for the entirety of the season, and then also as we get into the postseason and sorting out where everyone ends up seating wise, it's gonna serve them really well. And I was impressed all weekend, really, by both teams. But I it's hard to not be excited about the Pirates early on, and even UNC. But I really like the 1-2 punch that ECU has on the mound of Trey Yesavage and Zach Root. Yesavage is, again, they're two different looks. Thunderous fastball from Trey up to 97-98 with two distinct breaking balls that really flash. The split changeup on Friday night was actually super, super impressive. He didn't have great feel for his curveball. Slider was solid, but I was most impressed with that split change that he mixed in. And then with Zach Root, really impressive left-hander, is yet to allow an earned run this year, or a run in general. Advanced command and control, fastball up to 95 with a plus changeup, and then Jake Hunter has also been really good. The pitching staff as a whole, other than a couple of weird wonky appearances where they got hit a little bit, namely Danny Beal, who is usually excellent for them, they've also been very, very solid in the early going. And then offensively, we alluded to it in last week's podcast, and I know I did in my weekly What to Watch For piece, but where the production was going to come from outside of JJC, Jacob Jenkins Coart, and Carter Cunningham, and you saw guys like Jacob Starling step up. Bristol Carter obviously came through with a huge series-winning hit. Riley Johnson. It's a really fun, like, really fun, really good team that I think once you get into a postseason format too, they're going to battle like crazy, and they have the pitching depth to sustain a really deep run, I think. And they tripped a little bit yesterday, or depending on when you're listening to this, 2 days ago, against Old Dominion. But Old Dominion's always solid. You can't really ding a team too much for a midweek loss. Like, I know that doesn't really affect how I felt about them, felt about them coming out of the weekend. But very impressed with them. UNC, I think, is also a very high-quality club. They can really swing it. Pitching, I was impressed with Folger Bose's ability to battle and go toe-to-toe with Trey Yesavage. And they've got a number of weapons themselves. So two really fun teams. That was an outstanding series. That finale, like you said, it was kind of like a Big 12 football vibe in the later innings. Like, it was just punch after punch. And I'm with you that that whoever was hitting last was going to win. So a perfect ending to what was a great weekend.
I don't want to sit here and deep dive the UNC pitching staff too much right now. It's February. They've got time to work some things out. However, this weekend kind of made it look like they're really missing Jake Knapp, who was supposed to be their opening day starter, went down with an injury. I think he needs Tommy John in January. And, you know, like, it's great that Boaz, who's a freshman, by the way, has been able to, like, step up and be that guy on Friday night. But they need somebody else, and ideally two somebody else's, to step up as starters. Like, they're clearly trying to build the pitching staff from the back. Like, they have a good bullpen, but they need somebody to give them some sort of length on Saturday or Sunday, because the way that they're managing it right now, I just don't really find it to be sustainable once they get into the ACC. And, you know, they have a lot of talent. They might be able to find the guys, but right now, like, that looked to be a clear deficit coming out of this weekend against ECU.
Yeah, and there's arm talent there. We mentioned a few guys, like Dalton Pence has been really good out of the bullpen. Jason DeCaro, who they've largely used as a midweek guy, was excellent against VCU. Connor Beauvais, but as a whole, I think that we saw it this weekend kind of rear its ugly head. But as the season gets longer and, you know, stuff kind of starts to catch up to teams, no matter what it is, like, I have a feeling that the hole that Knapp left and him being out for the years, there are going to be perhaps a few ACC series where, like, we're sitting here on Wednesday or whenever we record being like, man, if Jake Knapp was still headlining that rotation, that's probably a series win as opposed to a series loss. So far from, like, a sky is falling mentality for UNC, like, for me, they're very clearly, like, you can't really talk about the tournament this early, but, like, they're obviously tournament team, like, potential hosts. But I think in terms of a ceiling standpoint, the loss of Knapp limits it a little bit. At least it looks it early on.
Yeah, if that's not going to be a limiting factor, they're going to need somebody to step up. And it's February. They got time for that. But where they are at now, like, they need another starter or two to emerge, or some sort of bulk guy in the bullpen, which UNC is great at developing historically, but we've got to find out who it is. And so, I mean, that's what the next couple months are for, but that is something to watch as you watch the Heels the rest of the way. We've got such a loaded slate ahead. I want to flip gears to talk about that. There was some more intrigue over the last week, to be sure. We wrote about a lot of it over at baseballamerica.com. So if you didn't hear it here, like, check it out. And we'll catch up with some of the other things that have happened over the week as we talk about these teams and what they've got on the slate for this weekend. And that's what we're going to do here in a second. But first, check this out.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. What I love about using Indeed is how it does a lot of that organizational work for me. I can sort through candidates. I can respond to them. I can schedule interviews all through Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses, including Baseball America, that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
All right, Peter, both of us are very excited for this week 3 slate. It is traditionally one of the best in the whole season. You've got This weekend, the Astros Foundation Classic, that is the tournament hosted at Minute Maid Park, the granddaddy of all of these non-conference multi-team events. It's been going on for more than 20 years. And it's got a new title sponsor this year, but that's happening this weekend. You've got several rivalry series, of course, South Carolina and Clemson, as is tradition, and Miami and Florida. So a lot of great baseball ahead of us. Let's start in Houston, though. The field this year is LSU, Vanderbilt, and Texas. Those are all top 15 teams, plus Houston, Louisiana Lafayette, and Texas State to round it out. It's a solid field. All six of those teams are tournament caliber teams. Obviously, the three top 25 teams are, or the top 15 teams are host caliber. But don't like just look at Houston, Louisiana, and Texas State not having numbers next to their name and be like, well, you know, I don't know. Those are good teams as well. And I'm going to have more about UH on the website here in the next day. So make sure to check that out if you want your Houston dive as they go into this tournament and then next week start Big 12 play for the first time. The highlight of the tournament, though, is going to be Friday night's Texas-LSU showdown. Obviously, a bit of a rivalry situation. I expect a great crowd for that one. And notably, Peter, this is LSU's first big test of the year. They've played at home for the first two weekends. They've played okay. I know they're not thrilled with the way they've played to this point. They haven't played anybody close to the quality of Texas. So a lot on the line here this weekend. As we record this, we don't know how LSU is going to line up its pitching staff, which is intriguing as well. So it's a little hard to like really bear down on the like LSU Texas analysis without knowing who LSU is going to throw in that game opposite LeBaron Johnson for Texas, who is coming off of eight scoreless innings against Cal Poly, but a very intriguing showdown between the Horns and the Tigers on Friday night.
Yeah, the field as a whole is really impressive. I'm happy that you mentioned and gave some love to Texas State, Houston, and Louisiana Lafayette, because those three are really solid clubs in their own right. But like you, outside of the Texas Vandy matchup on the third, that LSU Texas game on Friday night is
brunch.
The one that
brunch with Texas and Vanderbilt on Sunday.
I know. I'm going to get my Eggo French toast sticks and maybe a couple of slices of bacon and lock in. But no, I'm super fired up for it. I am really curious, like you are, to see who LSU trots out on Friday night, whether it is Thatcher Hurd or Luke Holman or, you know, whatever Coach Johnson has up his sleeve.
But yeah, I mean, it could be any of the three. It could be Hurd, Holman, or Gage Jump, who started on Thursday last week, has first started in LSU uniform. Hurd has been up and down the first 2 weeks of the season. And then Holman's pitched like the best of the group so far.
Holman's been outstanding. I selfishly, just from a sheer like watchability, like it's and not any less watchable depending on who they trot out. But if Luke Holman's towing the rubber, that makes this a heck of a lot more exciting. And I'm really excited to see how this LSU offense, which to this point has been swinging it well as a team. I think they're hitting over 330.
I don't know if Jay would agree with that, but continue. Like he lit up the team. He came out on Saturday after they won against whoever it was that they played on Saturday. Not Stony Brook, and was like, yeah, I just spent the last 20 minutes chewing out my hitters. So like they I don't know, the standards are high there, obviously, though.
Well, that I mean, hey, that's why like Coach Johnson, wherever he goes, and especially at LSU last year, you know, the best is the standard. That's what makes them so good. But no, I'm excited to see how they match up against the Texas pitching staff, which to this point has been one of the best in the country as a whole. Last weekend, they didn't give up a run to Cal Poly. It's headlined by LeBaron Johnson, who is on the very short list to take home Big 12 Pitcher of the Year honors. Eventually, I think they have a 180 ERA as a staff in general. And then behind LeBaron Johnson, Charlie Hurley has been really, really good in the early going. And they've got a bevy of weapons that they trot out in the bullpen. And that's a lineup that also has been swinging it reasonably well in the early going. I think they're also hitting around 330 as a team. Plenty of depth in the lineup. I've been most intrigued by and excited by the resurgence and bounce back of Jalen Flores. He was always able to pick it on the dirt, smooth defender, got a really good pro body. It was just all going to come down to the bat for him, and he's hitting 344. He just crushed two home runs, I think two grand slams. He hit at least one grand slam on Tuesday. I don't think it was two grand slams, but he had two home runs on Tuesday against St. John's. Looks really comfortable at the plate.
I think it's two grand slams this season is the two grand slams you're thinking of.
Yes, that's better said. Will Gasparino's been good going, been really good in the early going. Jared Thomas, obviously. Like, it's a really impressive Texas team. I think that it's hard to take anything away from just one individual game, but I think it could be a little bit of an Arkansas, Oregon State feel to it, obviously in the intensity and talent level that you're going to see on the diamond, but also in the fact that it's just going to be a really, really well-played professional baseball game where obviously someone's going to have to lose, but I think that you're going to walk away very impressed with both. And if it goes that like instant classic route, not even instant classic, but just a really well-played route, I think that people are going to be arguably more impressed with Texas just coming out of it. Again, because LSU is the defending national champions. They're kind of at the top right now. So I am super, super fired up for that one on Friday night.
Yeah, I think you're right that if it's a close game, regardless of who wins, people are probably going to come away saying good things about the Horns. And I just feel like the Texas slander over the last couple weeks, or not weeks, months, has been, I don't get it. Like, they're really, really, really good. And people are talking about them like they're terrible. I don't know. I have them in my 8 for Omaha. Now, they don't look exactly like what I thought they were going to look like coming into the year, because Tanner Witt has clearly not been ready. He's still working his way back from injury, and I kind of had thought by now he'd be further along than that. And, you know, we'll see where the rest of the season takes him and what role he ultimately settles into. But as of now, it hasn't, like, I mean, I know that to this point they've played San Diego and Cal Poly on weekends, and so of course it hasn't really caught up to them. But San Diego and Cal Poly aren't bad, and they've pitched incredibly well. LeBaron Johnson is just the latest Texas ace, and like, they're hitting really well and they're fielding really well. Like, I just think this is a really, really good team. And I know they're not in the top 10. They might be after this weekend though. And you know, I feel really good about them coming in. I hope that they play well to make me look good a little bit. But like, also so that the rest of the country can like come to a similar conclusion, maybe, that like, this is a really good baseball team. And I mean, they've just been so consistently good over the last few years that, you know, I know standards are really high at Texas, just like they are at LSU. And so if you're, you know, nobody's going to pat you on the back and say, good job on making super regionals again. Like, that's just kind of what you're supposed to do, if not go further. But it's a really good team with a really high ceiling. And they have a tough slate this weekend. They have the toughest slate of anyone, I feel like. They have LSU on Friday, Texas State on Saturday in a rivalry spot. I know the Bobcats are going to be up for that one. I know that there are going to be a lot of fans in the stands for that one. And then that brunch with Vanderbilt on Sunday. It's a tough, tough weekend for Texas. But I do think that, A, we can learn a lot about the Horns, and B, they have the ability to come out looking pretty darn good.
Yeah, not only is it a tough weekend where you have two top 10 matchups with number 2 LSU and number 9 Vanderbilt. You mentioned Texas State is going to give them a really good game, I think. If Texas is able to come out of this weekend with two wins, no matter who they beat, that is a massive, massive just win as a whole. And they're in a really tough stretch here as they start Big 12 play next weekend. They go from this gauntlet in Houston to a midweek with Texas A&M, and then they go to Texas Tech to open up conference play. But this is gonna be a really, really good barometer for Texas in a huge, huge test, because I think that they have a chance to make a serious, serious statement. I going forward in general, no matter how this weekend plays out, I'm very confident in their pitching staff. I'm just really curious to see how their lineup holds up as they get into Big 12 play. Namely, like if Jalen Flores can keep hitting, if Will Gasparino can keep hitting against conference arms, like Jared Thomas and Peyton Powell, I'm very, very confident in, but I'm curious if they can kind of sustain this look where, you know, there are five to six or seven legit weapons in the lineup, and that's without Porter Brown really getting going. So I don't get the slander at all. I'm with you. Like, their one loss on the year is to a solid San Diego team in 11 innings, I think, in the second game of the year. So one way or the other, I think in the early going, this weekend's going to say a lot about who Texas is and what their upside is.
Let's get to Vanderbilt here. Vanderbilt had a weird weekend, or a weird week, I guess, overall. If we rewind it a little bit, I don't remember if we touched on them losing to Dayton in a midweek last week. Then they went out and won a series against Gonzaga, but like finished it by blowing a massive lead on Sunday, which put people in all kinds of feels about where Vanderbilt is, because that was their third loss of the year. And then on Tuesday, they went out and hammered previously undefeated Indiana State. They scored 20 runs in that game, and that's an Indiana State team that can really pitch. They play again on Wednesday as we record this. Who knows what they'll have done against Evansville. But they've been a little up and down, I guess, is the point here. They're clearly trying to figure some things out. They don't know. It doesn't feel like they have a set lineup by any means yet. In fact, I know they do not have a set lineup by any means. It doesn't feel like they have everything figured out in terms of roles on the mound. It's February. They don't need to, but it is. I think that is, first of all, contributing to their up and down nature in the early going, and it is contributing to some of the angst about Vanderbilt in the early going.
Yeah, it's been a, you said it, it's just been kind of a weird year for them. Up and down for sure. It was, you're never going to complain about a series win, but it was a rather uninspiring and the least loud and maybe most quiet series win as you can kind of possibly have. It was not convincing in the slightest. And I'm with you, like, there's a lot that they're still trying to figure out as we get going here, especially on the mound. Like, that's kind of the one area that has me concerned early. I knew with the lineup, with the mix of freshmen that they have, a couple of newcomers, there was going to be some shuffling, and largely, like, they've shown times, especially on Tuesday against a good Indiana State team, that they can swing it, but the pitching staff early is a concern, and getting guys out and where those nine innings are going to come from on a game-to-game basis, and then on a weekend, like, where those 27 innings are going to come from, and like, who you can feel confident in. Obviously, Devin Futrell is the guy, like, he is anchoring that rotation, and then behind him, it's kind of like, again, you got to figure out where those innings are going to come from. Andrew Dukanich has been outstanding in the early going. He was a guy that we talked about as having maybe the best pure stuff on the staff, and from an arm talent standpoint, he is right there for one of the most talented guys, and early on he's showing it. But outside of that, like, Grayson Carter strike throwing has still kind of plagued him a little bit. We saw it recently. Bryce Cunningham has been solid. Carter Holton is still working back from, I believe, an injury he sustained, kind of getting his sea legs a little bit. And then I, like, one guy that I had circled that was going to be a key piece for him, and I'm sure that Coach Corbin did as well, was Sawyer Hawks from Air Force. He is, for lack of a better term, has looked pretty rough in the early going. And, like, they're just going to need arms outside of Futrell, and I think Dukanich to step up. Ethan McElvain, I think, is one who might be getting the ball on weekends sooner rather than later. He's an exciting arm talent. And then, yeah, it's just there's just like a lot of question marks. I know you have some. I know I have some about Vanderbilt on both sides of the baseball. And I think that this weekend they have – we talked about the depth of the tournament field, but they have as favorable a schedule as you can probably get in the tournament. They get Louisiana and Houston on Friday and Saturday before finishing it out with Texas. I think, assuming they beat Evansville today, if they don't beat Evansville, like, my tune would probably change on them a little bit. But if they can come out of this weekend with two wins, even if that's winning Friday and Saturday and losing Sunday, I think that that's what they need to do to go and take care of business, because a 1-2 weekend would not be great.
No, that's not what you want at all, obviously. Even in a tournament like this, where it's like, well, like, hey, the field is really good. You laid it out there, like, they don't have to play LSU. They don't have to play themselves. So, and they get Texas not on Friday with LeBaron Johnson. They get him on Sunday. Holton and Futrell are going to anchor that rotation ultimately. Like, Holton is, he wasn't ready on opening weekend to like be the starter, but like, those are your two guys that now they have to settle on a third, and it's been Cunningham early, and maybe it'll be Dukanich, and who knows what it'll end up being. But like, the bullpen is a real issue right now, and figuring out the rotation will help some of that, just getting later into the season so that they start using their starters further into games will help some of that. But they do need some guys to step up there. They've got the talent for it. They should have the depth for it as well. But right now that's been a little bit of the concern. And so that is something to watch this weekend, particularly, I guess, on Sunday, because they are facing Texas, a team that can hit on Sunday, you know, so we'll have to wait and see with Vanderbilt where they go from here. But it's probably not as rough as it's looked. I will say that like, if you just look at it and you're like, well, they have three losses already, and like, what happened to against Gonzaga? It's probably not that bad. It's early in the season, and we're prone to overreacting because that's all we have to react to. We'll see where they go. They could really use a big weekend in Houston, I think, to build some confidence here.
Yeah, winning solves everything. So they just gotta go out and do it.
All right, let's go to South Carolina. Speaking of Clemson had a little bit of a weekend to themselves. They got beat on Friday by Kennesaw State. It was the worst home loss in more than 50 years for Clemson. I think more than 70 years. I had to go back a really long time in the media guide. Like, it took me so long to find the answer that I don't have in front of me right now. And now I feel dumb for that. But that it was like, I should stop doing this, but I've spent so much time looking. Now I am like committed to know. Like, I was merely curious before, and now I need to know. But it was a brutal loss. To Clemson's credit, they bounced back and won the next two games. It wasn't easy, but they did ultimately get the series win against Kennesaw State. South Carolina lost for the first time on Saturday to Belmont. They also got beat pretty bad in that game, though not historically bad. They also come back, win the series, and now we have a top 15 matchup. The series starts in Columbia, starts at Founders Park. Then they move to the minor league stadium in Columbia on Saturday, finish in Clemson on Sunday. This is one of the best rivalries in the sport. It's a series that I'm looking forward to, not just from a atmosphere rivalry standpoint, though certainly that, but also just I want to learn more about these two teams. South Carolina has not played the hardest schedule yet, but they've looked very good to this point. And Clemson has kind of messed around for the first 2 weeks, and they aren't going to be able to against South Carolina. This also is a series that traditionally brings out the best in both teams. So I'm looking forward to this one for a number of reasons.
Yeah. It's one of, if not the best rivalry series in all of college baseball. Like, the environment in all three of the games is going to be an 80. I'm with you. I think that there is a lot to be learned about both these teams, and whoever can come away with a series win, that of course is going to go a long way. But South Carolina, outside of that one weird hiccup on Saturday to Belmont, where it lost 11-2, they've largely cruised. They have a few run rule wins to its name. I've been most like the X factor coming in for me, at least, was Roman Kimball on the mound and how he would return from injury. I'm a huge fan of him, both in the mound presence and then also what he brings, like arsenal wise and stuff wise. He's been huge for him. Eli Jones has been really good. Matthew Becker, they've been throwing it really, really well. And then offensively, contributions from like guys that have stepped up, like Dylan Brewer in the early going has been outstanding. Ethan Petrie. This is going to be a really fun matchup. Like you said, it's going to be a huge test because Clemson's rotation is obviously the best rotation they've seen to this point by a wide margin. When you've got Tristan Smith, Aiden Nock, a true freshman, has been he was really good on, I think, Sunday with 6 shutout innings against Kennesaw to clinch the series win. But like you've said, they were on the ropes and like have kind of fool around, for lack of better phrasing. They took an absolute beating on Friday night that you alluded to. We don't have to keep dwelling on that. But Saturday, they were 6 outs away from losing that series. And if it wasn't for a Jacob Hinderleiter game tying solo home run and then pushing another couple of runs across, like our tune is probably drastically different than it is right now. And they, in their midweek game against South Carolina Upstate, who's a solid club, like that's a game that the Spartans are obviously going to be very up for. They didn't pull away until late in that one either. They've been playing with their food a little bit, and they've got star power of their own. Cam Cannarella has been great. And then outside of him, in the early going, there hasn't been like a ton of production issues outside of Cannarella. The offense largely has been solid, but I'm curious as we get into both this series and then conference play, how it looks behind him. And if these pieces that have stepped up early, namely Alden Mathis, Jimmy Obertop, Nolan Naraki, and others, if they can kind of continue to be viable options in that lineup, a little bit similar to, in a different tone, but a little bit similar to how Clemson's looked early on in the early going, at least the dynamic of the lineup. And then I know that they would love to see Will Taylor get going, and they can hope that that 3-for-3, 3 home run performance against Upstate propels him and gets him going, because he's struggled in the early going. But the arm talent is exciting. And then I think that no matter who comes away with this series win, I know that we'll probably be feeling really good about him. I think more so maybe South Carolina, like if the Gamecocks can come away with a series win, it's a little bit like last year where I forget who it was, but they had a notable series win and everyone kind of came away from it like, okay, this team is for real, for real. And I think that I'll probably be feeling the same if they can take 2 from Clemson.
Yeah, I do think that that's right, that South Carolina probably needs this a little bit more to prove themselves, because there's been South Carolina slander out there too. And I shouldn't even call it slander. It's just that I use that phrase with Texas, and I feel similarly about South Carolina. I don't have them in my 8 for Omaha, but I am higher on South Carolina than the average college baseball analyst. And I understand where people are coming from when they look at South Carolina, but I do think, I guess I just believe, everyone believes in the lineup, I think. I just believe a little bit more in the arm talent and their ability to get the most out of it. So this weekend is an opportunity to show that if it's going to be the case. And I think people would have to respect them at a little bit different level if they are able to deliver this weekend. I mean, on the other hand, though, like we just spent some time talking about how Clemson hasn't looked the part yet, and everybody had them in the top 10 coming into the season, I think. So if they're going to be that. Now, obviously, like they got it going pretty late last year. And so like Eric Backich's teams, you can look at his time at Michigan as well. Like they often hit their stride later in the season. They don't start red hot. And, you know, so it's not like Clemson would be in a really problematic place if they lose the series. But some of the angst that is out there already, like, would get amplified if they lose. So it's an intriguing series from, again, a number of perspectives. Very much looking forward to it. One of the perspectives that we didn't touch on, I mean, I guess you did slightly, Peter, is Cannarella and Petri. And, I mean, that's an outstanding duo for 2025 in terms of outfielders at the top of the draft. In Georgia this weekend, you got Georgia and Georgia Tech squaring off again in a series that moves around. I think they start in Atlanta and then go to Athens and then finish at Triple A Gwinnett. That series is not as high profile. The only reason I'm talking about it right now is that Charlie Condon of Georgia has off to a scorching start at the plate. And Drew Burris of Georgia Tech hit 4 home runs on Tuesday. He now leads the nation with 9. He's off to an unbelievable start to his freshman year. Peter, if you can pick, like does the state of South Carolina have the better outfielders, or does the state of Georgia have the better outfielders?
Ooh, that's a great question.
Well, for this question, I'm classifying Condon as an outfielder, clearly, and that is debatable, and we're not going to get into that debate, but for the purpose let's call him a left fielder.
Yeah, we'll keep him an outfielder. One, that was an 80-grade transition from the Petri v. Cannarella into the Georgia Tech. That was outstanding. But it's splitting hairs a little bit. I'd probably give the edge to Petri and Cannarella. I think it's more established star power. Obviously, Condon is a stud in his own right, on his way to a top 10, probably higher draft choice eventually. Drew Burris has been the best freshman in the country. He's your freshman of the year. That is looking excellent in the early going.
One of my best picks ever.
Unbelievable. It could not be aging better so far, but I'd give the slight edge to the state of South Carolina. But on a series in and of itself, like, this is also a fantastic one. Georgia is 8-0. Georgia Tech is 7-1. It's the classic phrasing, but these two teams don't like each other. It's a great rivalry. In the early going, like, Georgia Tech, in kind of typical Georgia Tech fashion, I've been really impressed with how they've swung it. Drew Burris is Drew Burris. He's lighting the world on fire, but I've been impressed with the resurgence of Peyton Green. Parker Barocious has been kind of a great second leadoff hitter down at the bottom of the order. Georgia State transfer Cam Jones has been contributing both on the mound and in the dish. I've been most impressed though with how they've been pitching it so far. And granted, the competition has been far from stiff. They had an opening series against Radford and then Cornell with a pair of midweek games against Georgia Southern and Georgia State respectively. Southern's an especially solid club, but they've been throwing it really well. Aiden Finitari has come out and has been impressive. Cameron Hill, after a strong summer in the Cape League, he's been solid. He made his return to the rotation this past weekend. If they can pitch, this team becomes a lot more intriguing. And then I think from this 4-game stretch, 3 against Georgia and then a really fun midweek game against Northeastern, that's going to say a lot about like how legit Georgia Tech is early on. Like, is this a potential tournament team? You know, it'll say a lot about him. And then Georgia coach Wes Johnson has gotten off to a perfect start. Charlie Condon has been, in terms of 2024 draft guys, arguably the most impressive hitter to this point. Not only he has 20 hits, which I think is top three in the country at this point, but every single ball he hits, it seems like it's been absolutely torched. Like, the quality of impact he's generating is outstanding. He's flashing borderline double plus raw power with a plus hit tool to boot. The barrel sense has been excellent. Like, he's been unbelievable. And then they've gotten production from other guys like Slade Alford, most notably Florida Atlantic transfer Dylan Goldstein has looked good. Colby Branch. Like, this is a fun, intriguing Georgia club. I'm excited to learn more about the pitching staff as we keep going, but both these teams, I think, and especially Georgia, at least early on for me, you can kind of peg as a sneaky little dark horse going through the year. And I'm curious to see how Burris does as the competition stiffens up, because I have no doubt he'll continue to produce. I'm really excited to see like how much he produces. And if we're going to start talking about an historic season, which we already are, like my favorite stat that you tweeted yesterday, and it didn't get enough love, and I know you mentioned it in the article too, but of Drew Burris's 15 hits, 14 have gone for extra bases. He's got 5 doubles and 9 bombs, and he's got 1 single. I thought that was like my favorite stat of all. It made me laugh when I read it, because it's like, holy cow. But this is a really fun series, and it'll get overlooked because of what else is going on. But I'm very excited to follow this one closely.
It is bananas as a stat. And yeah, Elon, fix the algorithm, make that one do better. I think
I was going to say, when you saw that, I was like, oh man, that's a like common Teddy Cahill banger. And I was surprised to like go back to it before we hopped on. And I was like, that's the best stat, one of the best nuggets I've seen this year. But anyways.
Yeah, what I've learned is the internet does not love, or at least Twitter does not love my like weird little stats like that as much as I do. And like, that's fine. I'm going to keep like finding them and tweeting them. But they don't play quite as well. And also I threaded that one, which Twitter right now isn't like Threads, I don't think. Maybe if I tweeted that on its own, it would have worked better. But I think I threaded it.
Speaking of ruined stats though, Chase Mora potentially ruined another really good one.
Yeah,
I know you're trying to find the last time a freshman hit 4 home runs in a game, and then Chase Mora did it last year.
Well, like people were like going crazy yesterday as Burris is hitting all these home runs, much like they were on Friday when Hagen Smith was striking everyone out. Like Twitter was very much paying attention yesterday, and people were like, "Oh my God, he's a freshman!" And I was like, "Yeah, he is a freshman. Like, let me see. Like, what's that?" What's that add to this? And so like, I figured I was going to be looking for a while. And then I like open up the list of like 4 homer. Well, I kind of have to create the list, but whatever. Like I'm looking at guys that have hit 4 homers in a game. And there were 2 last year. And 1 happened to be by a freshman, Chase Mora, Texas State. So sorry, Chase Mora, for not paying attention to that last year. But yeah, like it was, I thought that was going to be rare. It turned out not to be, or at least not as rare. But Drew Burris, 9 homers in the first 8 games. The other thing that was crazy when I was looking into it is it's almost exactly what Tommy White did as a freshman. He also hit 9 home runs in his first 8 games. He did not have a 4 home run game. He only had a 3 home run game on opening day. And I remember distinctly thinking to myself, I don't know if I ever said it publicly, though I may have, like, hey guys, maybe slow down. NC State hasn't really played that great of a competition yet. And all Tommy White did was hit 27 home runs that year. So like the rate will slow down because it has to slow down for 2 reasons. One, like that's just the way like things work. Like regression is a real thing. And the other thing is that like at this point, Georgia Tech is playing teams that, I mean, they want to win the games, but like they don't really care that much. Whereas when they get into conference play, if Drew Burris is still doing this, they're just going to stop pitching to him. Yesterday against Georgia State, he got a fastball in a fastball count in his first at bat, and he deposited it over the left field fence. And it wasn't a BP fastball, but it was a mistake, and Drew Burris knew exactly what to do with it. Like, I don't think ACC teams are going to do that to him. Like, after that, Georgia State threw him a bunch of breaking balls, and he also homered off of those. But I think ACC teams will skip the fastballs and fastball counts and just go straight to like, here, hit a slider, like hit this changeup, or here's a fastball off the plate, like please swing or don't, it's okay. And so like those two things are going to contribute to just slowing his ridiculous rate down, but he is really good. He probably actually, no, he should not be in college baseball. And if he were bigger, he wouldn't be. They list him at 5'9". I've been told that if you go find the East Coast pro roster, he was 5'7", now about 18 months ago. He can grow maybe, but like that 5'7" is probably a little closer to true than the 5'9".
Don't let, like you said, and like you said in your piece on him and just in talking about him, like don't let the compact frame fool you. Like there are a ton of tools packed in here. You obviously mentioned the thunderous bat speed. You've got the plus raw power. He's also a great athlete in the outfield. He's held down center field well. He's got plus arm strength. Like there's a, like there is a lot to like, even when you start to look under the hood here, and like the operation in the box, like I've just been, he blew people away with it in his high school days and on the summer circuit and whatnot, but seeing it live at the college level, you know, you obviously care who they play, but like as a true freshman doing this, you know, I don't like the fact he's doing this is makes it that much more impressive, I think. Again, super, super great athlete, both in the field and in the box. Thunderous bat speed. The barrel just, I mean, it zooms through the zone. I love how he extends through the baseball, finishes beautifully. And even on, I think it was his second home run of the day, he got a 2-1 break. Like, he got a 2-1 breaking ball. He's clearly sitting fastball. Like, he was way out on his front side. But again, like you talk about the bat speed, like he caught it out front, like, and was able to drive it and lace it into that netting beyond left field. And like with that thunderous bat and hand speed on display, like it's just a really special talent. I'm selfishly very intrigued and excited to see how this looks in ACC play because he's obviously very talented and right now the best freshman in the country. There's no debating that. But I'm curious to see like just how good of a player we've got on our hands here, because like you said, the quality of pitching is obviously going to tick up. The stuff is going to tick up. How they pitch got, like how they pitched to Burris, like the sequencing of pitch, it's just going to, everything is going to become a lot better and a lot more advanced. And I'm curious to see how he handles that. He's already signed to play this summer in the Cape League. We're now getting way ahead of ourselves, ahead of myself talking about summer ball, but really looking forward to seeing how he does as the competition continues to ramp up.
The last thing I got on him is that we also can say like, oh, who have they played? And fair, but he has more than double the home runs of anybody else on his team. There are two guys on Georgia Tech that have four home runs. He has 9. So yeah, Georgia Tech might not have played amazing competition, but Georgia Tech has other good players, other good hitters, and they are not home run at anywhere near this rate. So, you know, like I may be talking to myself more than anything here, because in the past I have like looked at players like this and been like, well, but like, let's see him at conference play. I'm like, they're going to slow down. That's fine. But like, that doesn't mean that they're bad. Like Tommy White went out and had a freshman of the year season after starting this way. And I like, there's no reason why Drew Burris can't do that as well. Now he's going to have to make adjustments because they're going to pitch him differently. And, you know, if they're, I'm sure they're already talking to him at Georgia Tech about how like, when you have to be selective, like don't let them force you to expand, blah, blah, blah. But like this weekend's going to be really interesting because UGA with Wes Johnson leading them is going to have a really good plan. And we'll see, we'll learn a lot about UGA's pitchers because also the Bulldogs haven't played anyone particularly. I think that's an incredibly interesting matchup to watch this weekend. It's a little off the radar because there are no numbers next to either of their names. But just one loss between the Bulldogs and the Yellow Jackets. Last one to touch on. There's so many things we could be here all day, but one more. We got the Frisco Classic. That is Indiana, Dallas Baptist, Alabama, and Arizona in Frisco, Texas. IU went out and lost a really dumb game. They should not have done this yesterday. They lost to Purdue Fort Wayne. Purdue Fort Wayne, that's a loss. Like, I often, like, I have said many times that, like, hey, any midweek loss is fine. Like, it doesn't really matter. Like, it's not really going to affect you. This one actually is going to stick with Indiana the rest of the year, unless Purdue Fort Wayne is way better than they were last year. Last year, they were like 286 in RPI. IU lost to them at home. So that's going to just stick with the Hoosiers. It snapped a six-game winning streak of theirs. Brutal, brutal loss. This is an opportunity to get right, though. It's a tough weekend. DBU comes in playing outstandingly. They just beat Oklahoma State last night. They've been great so far this season. Alabama leads the nation with 9 wins. They haven't played anyone, but they're a good team. And I have no idea what to make of Arizona through the first 2 weeks of the year, but I do know they're good enough to beat any of the teams in this field. So I think this is a fun little compact 4-team tournament in Frisco this weekend.
Yeah, you hit on it perfectly. DBU's banging right now. Very complete club offensively. Talent on the mound with Ryan Johnson and other supplemental arms. I'm very curious to see how Indiana responds to a weird, shocking, bad loss to the Macedons of Purdue Fort Wayne. They can't let that snowball. Like, they gotta just flush that right away and get and turn the page, because they can't afford to come into this weekend at all dwelling on what was, because I mean, you open up with Bama and Ben Hess, like that matchup with
could this not have been Ryan Johnson versus Ben Hess?
That and also even Connor Foley for IU. But again, you've got Ben Hess, and then the following day you've got DBU, who, like, you talk about a test for an arm, like Connor Foley, that's a huge one. Like, that lineup is going to be one of the best he sees potentially all year. And then Arizona, I think that they are a better than expected team early on. I'm curious to see like what kind of problems they cause in the Pac-12. Mason White is a very, very good player and a premier sophomore. Brandon Summerhill's been good early on. They have some intriguing talent on the mound with Anthony Susak and a few other guys. So this is a very fun 4-team field. There are no easy matchups for anyone, no matter how you slice it. So I think, again, similar to the baseball at the beach, a little throwback to 2 weeks ago, whoever can come out of this with 2 wins to its name has to be feeling really good.
Shout out to the guy in my mentions from the weekend who was like,
oh boy,
the fall is coming for Indiana or something, like something about calling Indiana a fraud. And then like 2 days later, I was like, damn, that guy, he was all over it.
like the Ides of March.
Except yeah, it was it was Big Ten slander a little bit, because what it was responding to how bad Iowa was over the weekend. It was like the Big Ten is just a bunch of frauds, and just wait till this weekend, Indiana's gonna get found out. And I was like, well, you didn't even have to wait till the weekend. You know, I don't know what to make of that loss. I do know that they're gonna be ready on Friday, and they've got to be, because like you said, Ben Hess and Alabama are no joke. I just think this is a really this is a weekend where whoever comes out of this with 2 wins, whatever 2 or 3 teams come out of this with a winning record, can feel really good about themselves. And if you go 0-3 or 1-2 this weekend, like, it's going to sting and it's going to hurt, but like, it's not as bad as that's going to feel like in all likelihood. And you know, Todd Whitting, the Houston coach, told me this specifically about the Astros tournament, which he has a ton of experience in over the years. He's coached in 14 of them. That you're never as good as you think you are. No, you're never as good or as bad as you think you are coming out of Minute Maid. And look, Frisco isn't that, but I do think that you're not, whoever comes out of this with losses, you're probably not going to be as bad as you feel coming out of this weekend in Frisco. You might be as good as you are, as you feel, if you go 3-0 this weekend. Like, that's on, I am willing to concede that that might be the case, but the losing team or teams this weekend in Frisco, it's probably not going to be as bad as it feels at the time.
Yeah. I mean, whoever comes out of this 3-0, if someone comes out of it undefeated, like, that's as big a statement as you can make. And
I will say it's going to be Dallas Baptist if anybody does it. That, I'm calling my shot here. That I got like DBU. If anyone's going 3-0 this weekend, I got DBU.
I like it. I can't let you be the only one to make a call. That'd be unfair and kind of leave you on the stake. I'll take for a 3-0 weekend. I got Indiana. I think they're gonna bounce back. I like them as a whole. I think that while that Purdue-Fort Wayne loss will unfortunately stick on their resume, especially the RPI for the rest of the year, you've got a golden get right weekend here. Granted, it's against really, really stiff competition, but if you win two or three here, if you're Indiana, that you immediately forget about what happened on Tuesday. I'm a hopeful and bullish on them to kind of bounce back. And then, not to prematurely close the book on Frisco, but one more multi-team event that I'll be focused on is the Las Vegas College Baseball Classic. I think that's a really sneaky field. Mostly looking at you, Cal, in Oklahoma, have that Saturday game between the Bears and Sooners, Golden Bears and Sooners circled. I think that Cal early on looks really good, and I think that they're going to take a lot of people by surprise in the Pac-12, and they're only going to get better with Ian May coming back. Oklahoma has some fun pieces. Braden Davis on Fridays is a guy that they have to love trotting out. He's got a plus changeup, fastball into the 94-95 range that he hides well, and then the Witherspoon brothers, and then some supplemental pieces offensively with Spikerman, Jackson Nicholas, Easton Carmichael. Those are two really intriguing clubs. So I will mostly be dialed into that Saturday game between Cal and Oklahoma, but I'm curious to see if Cal can come out of this with another like series win equivalent, because we discussed them for the top 25 on Sunday, and if they win two more games, they will very much be discussed again, depending on what happens.
The other two teams in that tournament are Pitt and Ohio State. And don't look now, but Pitt is 6-1. I mean, you can side eye their schedule if you want, but they're 6-1. They obviously haven't played at home yet. And Ohio State is 4-4, but they were messing around with almost winning a four-game series at Arizona State last weekend. Like, they ultimately split it. But that's an intriguing one. There's so much. I'm going to run through some things real quick here that we're not going to talk about, but like, just know that literally anywhere you look this weekend, you will find good baseball. You've got Florida at Miami, obviously a rivalry, little bit, not as exciting because Miami has, you know, Miami is what they are this year, and we don't really know what they are yet, but it is, J.D. Ortega's first time being in charge of his alma mater for that rivalry series. You got South Florida and UCF in another rivalry in the state, that one hosted by UCF. Indiana State is at Southern Miss. That is like the under the radar series of the weekend, although it would be a lot cooler if Indiana State had been better against Vanderbilt. I don't even want to say like won the game, but just not got blown out on Tuesday night. But both of those teams off to really good starts. UCSB is going to Oregon. That is a venue shift due to ongoing problems with UCSB's field. UCSB really needs this one. Oregon also off to a sneaky, quietly good start. So interesting series there. Iowa seeking a get right weekend goes to Ole Miss, kind of in a just looking to jumpstart its season. Interesting series in Oxford. And then UConn seeking a get right weekend after getting swept at Berkeley goes to Auburn. I wish the Huskies luck with that. But that will be a good, like, that's just not where you want to go needed to get right. But that should be a pretty solid series as well.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was it for what I had circled. And then like elsewhere, you have the the Dodger Stadium baseball classic, I think they're calling it. Like, you, anywhere you look in any region of the country, there's great baseball being played. So this is a heck of a weekend, and it leads into it's a perfect segue into the start of conference play and more marquee matchups. Like, we're in the thick of it now, and it's only going to hopefully keep getting better as we keep going further along.
Absolutely. The Dodger Stadium Classic this year, traditionally that's USC and UCLA co-hosting, and then they finish at Dodger Stadium. This year, for whatever reason, USC is not involved. It's UCLA and UC Irvine, which frankly is better because Irvine is undefeated right now. And USC is decidedly not. But that, I'm just glad to have that one back at Dodger Stadium, the finale. It hasn't been there since 2019 due to renovations mostly. I think some COVID mixed in, but with the Dodgers hosting the All-Star game, there was some renovation. They couldn't use the stadium. So I'm glad that that tournament has returned to its original format, or close to its original format, because I was concerned that it just wasn't going to, that once they'd stopped there for like 5 years, they were just going to be like, well, why are we even doing this? But I'm glad to see that one back. And UCLA looking for a get right after getting swept at TCU last weekend, one of the series we did not get to. We will have plenty to talk about next week on another edition of the Baseball America College podcast, obviously, since we had so much to talk about on this one in terms of preview. So make sure you are subscribed to the Baseball America podcast on your favorite podcasting app, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Peter is at Peter G. Flaherty. And Peter, I realize that I just like shout out Twitter all the time because like that's what I've done forever and I'm a lot older than you. But like, do you want to shout out your other platform? Because like you're probably even bigger on that one.
Yeah, no, like Twitter, I'm constantly on the good old Bird app from really any time college baseball is being played, just pumping out analysis, updates, reactions, and whatnot. But over on baseballamerica.com, a lot of stuff and content going on over there as well. I have my weekly What to Watch For piece, which by the time you're listening will be up, where I dive into 5 series/ multi-team events and kind of just chop it up how we did here, analyze it a little bit, what to expect. And then every Monday, Teddy and I collaborate on the top 25. Every Thursday, or every Friday rather, draft podcast with draft writer Carlos Collazo. And then every Thursday, like you're listening to now, we have our college pod. And then a little bit more down the road, I will be releasing in 3 weeks an initial 2026 ranking. For those keeping track, those are the true freshmen in college right now. So hint, hint, you'll probably see a guy that we talked about a lot at this in this episode at number one. So there's a ton of it's a content blitz, rather for from now until really through the end of the Cape League season, which is the second week in August. So it, for me, it's the best time of year. It's also the busiest, but it's the best time of year.
Peter's got a lot of stuff going on as well, obviously. And, so make sure you check out baseballamerica.com. We will be busy this weekend. We're looking forward to it. Hopefully you are too. And we'll talk to you all next week on another edition of the Baseball America College podcast. See you then.